The reason that we suggested that maybe you might want some of your older children even to leave is because this psalm is hard-hitting. In fact, this last week, I'm at the beach, and I'm hanging out, and I get a text from my new communications guy, Dante, sitting up here taking a picture of me right now. Is this good? Does this? Okay. And he says, you know, that little blurb that you send out, your dear, dear First Press family, he said, it's really jarring. We thought maybe, you know, I talked to some of the other pastors, we thought maybe you might want to tone it down. And what you got was the sanitized version of it, if you read it. It was jarring, and it was meant to be jarring. And if you'll forgive me, I'm going to kind of jar you a little bit right here. Because this text is jarring. It's in the Bible, and it's so hard-hitting. So I want you to picture with me what's happening. There's this war, and they lost badly. Babylon marched through the small country of Israel and destroyed it. That's how the history tells the story, right? They destroyed it. One country won and one country lost. And now we just move on. We know that that's what happened. And we tell our history. This country won, this country lost. But that's not the reality. The reality is they went through hell. The reality is brutal and horrific and devastating. And Israel was destroyed. It destroyed. But we just use that like they were destroyed. But I want you to think that through with me, what that looks like. Yitzhak was killed in the original onslaught, an arrow through his neck. His brother was gutted in a field. The temple, too, was gutted. All the holy items burned or carried away. The temple torched for days. The brother of the first two was set on fire with the temple because, well, why not? Each sister was raped in turn. Two of them over and over again. Two others literally thrown over the shoulders like you see in the pictures of big men and carried away, never to be seen again. The baby was wrenched from the mother. Think that through. This child is smashed. The young teenager put in a carriage, taken, never to be seen. Can you imagine the wailing? Not for a few minutes, but for days and days. Can you imagine the cry never dying down? And then finally, you find yourself in this new land. The wails are all around you. You're in this new land. Your home has been taken over and your people devastated. It's the most brutal, evil, satanic, harsh thing that you can imagine. And if you still believe in a God after that, which they're trying to, then your faith is probably stronger than most of the peoples around you, because we all want to believe. We all want to hold on to that thing. We want to sing praises again. We want to feel the pleasure of God on our skin. But put yourself in their place. You know God is real, but the temple, the place that he dwells, it's gone. It's leveled. Real, but at least right now, disappeared. He's gone. He's got no place to live. There's no singing. The only thing left at this point is crying and cursing. And I'm guessing some of you have been there. A child who's died. A little girl's innocence is stolen. A crushing lie about you that is believed. A spouse that has betrayed you and left. Your theology may remain the same, but the pleasure, the joy of your salvation is gone. This is the situation we find ourselves in Psalm 137. Psalm 130, I want you to look at it. Look at this text with me. It's not that long. It's 9 verses. I want to read it with you. I want you to see it in black and white. I want it to grab hold of you. It says this, "By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is he who repays you for what you have done to us. He who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. Blessed are you? It's the kind of song that gives Christians a bad name. Like, is this what we sing? It's not only lacking in all the smiles and the joy that we know we're supposed to have as good Christians, right? We know it doesn't have, it's a song of misery. And then it's got this evil twist at the end, an imprecation, a curse on them. Blessed is he who repays you by dashing your infants against the rocks. I mean, it's one thing to say that Israel sings songs about vengeance. Like, if I just told you that, you'd be like, yep, we know that happens. That doesn't have any real meat. It's kind of like saying Israel got destroyed. Yep, we know. But there's nothing there with that. But when Israel is destroyed, means something like God is defeated. Dad has been killed. Little sister has been molested. It becomes palpable, doesn't it? There's so much more there. When vengeance is understood as a call for someone or even for God himself to come and crush your enemies, to crush babies' skulls, if you're crying out for that, if you feel that, doesn't that grab you in a way that maybe you don't really want to be grabbed? Like, this is our Bible. And I want to wrestle with this, but I want to slow it down just a little bit. I want to see each section, because in this loss that they're going through, you can hear the cries, can't you? That's the first few verses here. In loss, we cry, and not a mild crying, a valley of the shadow of death crying, a darkness is my only friend, Psalm 88 kind of crying, the tears of someone who's lost everything and everyone. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars, we hung our harps. I'm guessing they were probably smaller harps than this. They've gotten rid of their instruments that they sang these songs on. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing for us one of the songs of Zion. And how can we sing songs of the Lord in a foreign land? It's the exile. They've been removed from their home, and you can understand at least a fraction of what they're going through. I'm guessing this hasn't specifically happened to you, but people have been forcibly removed from their homes. Keep in mind, it's not that they don't have a home. It's not that they're homeless. It's that they have a home, but someone else is living in it and giving you the finger. You're not coming in here. This is our house. You've been removed from this house. It's been taken over by the people you hate most. See, being in an exile doesn't mean you have no roots. It means you have these deep, entrenched roots in this land, and you've been plucked up, and the roots are just writhing and dangling there and thrown aside. It's that kind of a feeling, exposed to this cold, jeering world, longing to be returned to that native, rooting, beautiful soil again. Exile is knowing where you belong, but knowing you can't go back, at least not yet. But it's more than exile from where you live. It's not just geographical movement. It's exile from life as you know it. Everything that you held dear, your home is gone. But not just your home, your wife is not the same anymore. She'll never be the same. Your little girls don't smile anymore. Your boys react with everything with animosity. There's some bitterness deep down. The life that you knew, the white picket fence, the home that you had, the gardening, the cows, the whatever you had, it's gone. You're not going to get those smiles anymore. There's no home. There's no rest. Everything is gone, and only weeping remains. It's that Lamentation 5, joy is gone, and dancing has turned into mourning. And in case you think it can't get worse, now the enemy comes in and they start taunting you. They start saying, hey, sing us a song. Sing and dance. I know some of you experienced hopelessness. I've heard from a lot of you, so I truly know, that you've experienced these things, utter despair. David symbolizes the cords of death, of moats have reached up, the tentacles of Sheol, of the grave, have reached up and grabbed him down into the sea. That metaphor, does it fit for some of you? You just feel like something's grabbing you and pulling you down and you can't get back up. Maybe it's the boyfriend has left. You failed at school again. Maybe your husband just can't seem to get it. This marriage is nearly over. And maybe the diabetes is so painful, or the bipolar just can't seem to get leveled out. And even for a minute, or your spouse actually makes your faith harder, or your spouse is never home, or maybe they're never home. Maybe they're gone. They're gone for good now. Or maybe the job isn't treating you like a woman, like a man that you are. Or you have no job, or maybe a thousand other things that cause you despair. You're going through these things. Israel's may not be worse than yours, or it may be worse than yours, and it doesn't matter whose is worse. This isn't a comparison, but you can feel it. There's no dancing. There's no singing. The harps get hung up. We're not doing that anymore. In loss, we cry, of course. And these next couple verses, we confirm. We remember. We have this confidence. We will hold on to this. We've lost all this, but we will not forget. We will remember the way things were. The psalmist takes this oath. I will keep this in my mind to be loyal to my past. It's been stolen. His faith is taking a beating, but we will together, we'll sing this, we'll remember. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, this is verse 5, may my right hand forget its skill. Whatever I've got the power to do, may it be done. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I don't remember you, if I don't consider Jerusalem my highest joy. This is curse on yourself. If we forget the covenant, the temple, the presence, the kingship of God, the atonement, the forgiveness, the reconciliation, if we forget, then our right arm will wither. It'll go into nothing. The tongue will cling to the roof of our mouth. It's a curse language. It's the old curse from elementary school, right? Stick a needle in my eye. It's hope to die. It's like, we'll hold on. This is our promise. This is our oath that we will do. Remember, O Lord, what the Edomites did, verse 7, on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Can you hear the frustration they have towards the Edomites? The Babylonians have come in and taken them. The Edomites are helping almost, taunting alongside with them. They laugh as Babylon decimated them. Even the language you hear, you can hear the metaphor, tear it down to its foundations. It's this metaphor of being stripped to her foundation, personified as women and daughters, Babylon and Israel. And verse 8 cries that the daughter of Babylon will be destroyed the same way the daughter of Jerusalem has been stripped down to their foundation. More physical, more than just physical foundations, more than stones after stones coming down, but the foundations of their life, of law, of their faith, everything, all the things that they stand on have been decimated in the destruction of this temple. Right? There's a whole doctrine called the inviolability of the temple. You can't be destroyed because this is God's place, and it just was. But we will remember. We will hold on. It's the cry to remember. It's the cry that we had on September 11th. We will remember. We'll remember America is strong. It's the cry of the Jews after Auschwitz. We'll remember, we'll hold on. It's the cry of the Palestinians or the Syrians or right now the Ukrainians are being moved out of their homes. It's the cry, we will remember who we are. Those who just pretend that this is the new order, they can come in and take our land and that's it. 50, 60, 70 years go by and now we just forget all about it. Like, well, we just have to move on. We don't have to move on. It's not the way it is. We will remember. I will not be content. And so they cry out and they confirm, we will hold on to this. We will remember. In loss, we cry. In loss, we confirm. And in loss, we curse. And don't try to explain this away. I want you to feel it. Happy. Blessed is he who repays you for what you have done to us. He who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. This does not disappear easily. And if for some reason you can make some exegetical manipulations or something to make it go away, you still have to deal with Psalm 109. Let his days be few. Let another take his office. Let his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. Let his children wander about and beg. And let them seek sustenance far from their ruined homes. Let the creditor seize all that he has. Let the strangers plunder the product of his labor. Let there be none to extend loving kindness to him, nor any to be gracious to his fatherless children. Let his posterity be cut off in a following generation. Let their name be blotted out. This is what we're praying against the people that upset us. And if you could somehow do something with that one, you got to deal with Psalm 58. Break their teeth in their mouths, O God. And if you can get rid of that one, then you have to deal with the other 15 psalms that include curses. 65 total verses calling God explicitly to terminate their enemies in the most gruesome way possible. And let's go ahead and admit it for a second. We kind of get it, don't we? If your spouse was raped, abused, kidnapped, terrorized, not only would you be demanding justice, you'd be figuring out a way to make sure you beat the law to the home of that person, wouldn't you? You might not want to admit it. Maybe some of you would like to admit it. I'll get there before the law and I'll deal with him. There's not going to be justice. There's vengeance. I want to deal with this. We get the sentiment, even if we're horrified by it, or maybe we should be at least. I mean, babies against rocks, really? Really? You're thinking, well, you know, that is exactly what they did to us. They did that, so we want to repay them. And lex talionis, the law of retaliation, allows for some sort of equal retribution. Still, sure, but what about Jesus? Is this, we say we want to be biblical. What does that mean to be biblical? Is this the part that we want to hold on to? Walter Kaiser speaks the heart of many Christians. He says this: perhaps there's no other part of the Bible that gives more perplexity and pain to its readers than this. Perhaps nothing that constitutes a more plausible objection to the belief that the Psalms are the productions of inspired men than the spirit of revenge, which they sometimes seem to breathe, and the spirit of cherished malice and implacableness, which the writer seems to manifest. It's about 17, 18 years ago, I published on this in a journal, and as I was presenting this paper on the imprecations in the Psalms and biblical theology and how it all works together, I started it off by asking people to sing a psalm with me, and we sung this psalm. You could see on the faces the awkwardness as they're singing this last verse. Blessed is he who bashes the baby's skulls against rocks. They're like, what am I singing? From the Bible. I think before we can continue, we have to wrestle with this. How can this be here in Psalm 137? Should we be thinking, well, it's in the Bible, so therefore it must be okay. We should be able to think these things, right? And if you start thinking, well, the psalmist obviously is okay with this, then you've got to figure out, well, also, Job is commended because he doesn't think such things. He doesn't say these terrible things about his enemies. Like, this is a good job, Job, that you didn't say these things. Good job, Psalmist, that you did say these. What's happening here is these two different sides are coming at us in Scripture. We can understand the sentiments. That's not hard, because we know our own darkness. But should this even be seen as darkness? Is this a bad thing or a good thing? Can I sing this psalm? Does God want us together to sing this psalm? Because it fits into 150 psalms in here that Israel continued to sing. If you read through the lectionaries, I did some research on this, you'll find that they skip these kinds of things. When you're reading through and you're just going, it just kind of goes here, and then it skips this verse, and then it starts up again here. Are we supposed to hold, are these sacred? What are we supposed to do with this? And my response is not easy. In order to respond to this, things are not black and white. For me to answer this, and I'm not going to answer this in some kind of final way, but to answer it, to even have an attempt at answering it, puts me right on the edge of orthodoxy. I've got to, I don't know where exactly to go with this and these dangerous thoughts, and they worry me, and I don't want to go too far in a simple sermon because I want you to see Jesus, and that's where I'm heading with all of this, but I have to say something because I feel like sometimes we think that maybe that is the kind of God we're supposed to worship, a God who wants us to cry out that babies be smashed because it's right there. If you think that Jesus would in any way condone praying this prayer to God that their teeth would be broken in their heads or that we would bless those who kill children, then I gotta say this, I think we worship kind of different gods. I think you're missing something. I don't quote Rob Bell often, but here is a killer quote. Maybe that's the wrong words, but he says, oftentimes when I meet atheists and we talk about the God they don't believe in, we quickly discover that I don't believe in that God either. Maybe some of us are just picturing God wrong. Maybe we become so filled up with crud the movies brings in and books and right-wing idiocy that far, by the way, spoken from a guy who spends more time on the right wing than left, but all those things that are coming in and that we've ignored true Christianity, the Christianity that's continued for centuries quietly in the background, we forget about that. What if God isn't like our warmongering politicians and our vengeful war movie heroes? What if God isn't even... Here's where I get to the edge. What if he isn't even exhaustively to be understood in the Old Testament? And not completely. Like, there's something there for us, but maybe not everything. I think what we have in the Old Testament, here's where we get into hermeneutics and we just put on your thinking caps, think with me, just play with me with this text. I think what we get in the Old Testament is an impartial, incomplete, and even, I'm going to use this word, inadequate theology. I'm an Old Testament PhD. This is my life, Hebrew Bible. I think it's incomplete. It's an attempt by humans when they're writing to hate in a covenantal way the same things that God hates. That's good. That's a beautiful thing that we should be doing. Saying, what does God hate? We want to hate those kinds of things too. It's an attempt to understand a God who's completely holy and demands holiness from us. We read this, right? Be perfect as I am perfect. And that has some other meaning. We'll get to that when we do the Sermon on the Mount. But still, right? It's that thing, and that's good. But those same people living in their context that they live in, they sing in, they're dealing with all of these things. They think that God is shown most holy and most powerful the way in their particular culture, in their context, they understand God is most holy. And what they mean by this is he's bigger than your God. He can crush your God. He can crush the bad guys. It's people on the playground. My dad's bigger than your dad. That's the way that they lived. In order to show the greatness and the power of God, we had to say, your God can destroy these other gods. That's what they're doing. They're hating what God hates means killing our enemies. That's the world that they lived in. But what if even then, even in the Old Testament, we have these counter responses where God says, no. What if he sent them prophets over and over again to say something a little bit different? You just don't quite get it. And what if every time the prophet steered them away from elitism and away from vengeance and away from war and focused them more on justice and love and mercy? What if every time that happened, they abused, tortured, and killed these particular prophets? Don't take us in that direction. We know the way we're supposed to live. We see it all around us. And what if God said, finally, I'm going to send a totally different kind of prophet, a prophet who doesn't look like Ezekiel tying himself up. He doesn't look like Isaiah preaching naked. He's not thrown into a pit like Jeremiah, but a prophet, all the same, just like those other ones, but more, a prophet who said, the answer isn't vengeance on your enemies. It's just not. It's all about love. What if this prophet who heard these curses, these imprecations, who understood everything, all the anger that's embedded deeply in them, a prophet who knew these Babylonians deserved to have their babies crushed, maybe? He knew all of that. And he knew that the Romans deserved this just hand, this strong right arm. And with the power to do all of that, to destroy them all in the worst possible way, he decided instead to let himself be crushed. What if there was such a story? I gotta wonder if we missed God. With our adamancy, we'll carry guns and we will use them. We'll get justice. We'll do these terrible things. All our skin. There must be consequences. So let's support these candidates that go to war with this country and this country and this country. I'm swearing under our breath, I'll teach them a lesson. And this is not a political argument right here. I'm not thinking about anybody in particular. I'm thinking about the last hundreds of years in all kinds of countries with that kind of mentality. Even now, with our own things, we will get them. If it's us or them, it's going to be them. What if this psalm still remains so that we can remember what life was like before the cross when Jesus called us out from it? What if us or them means us for them? I know there's still a million theological, biblical questions that need to be wrestled with, and I'm going to continue to do that in my own work. Let me speak to the reality that we all feel in this psalm. This psalm is the evidence of real pain, hurt. It's evidence of a desire to remember the past and what was stolen, crying, confirming, and it's evidence of a craving for justice, if not vengeance. So do you cry? And do you curse? Oh, not at church. We don't do those kinds of things here. That wouldn't be proper. Maybe we cry sometimes, happy tears, but not wailing, and certainly not cursing, not here. But isn't this exactly the place for raw, for real, for you to express the sentiments of your heart to people who actually get them and actually don't have painted faces most of the time? Isn't this the place where we wrestle with our feelings about others and even our feelings about God sometimes, and we remember that God is big enough to handle your anger and your humanness, your pain? How many of you are angry sometimes? I mean, you should be. Life sucks sometimes. It's hard. I mean, imagine yourself with Elias Shakur and all of those others that were marched away from their home. A large percentage of people in Palestine carried out of their homes, not allowed to return because the people around them had bigger guns or had guns and they didn't have any. Put yourself in that position. Would you be angry? How what are they doing? They're building walls in between my olive groves, which is how I take care of my people. I can't even get to the olive groves that have been in my family for 17 generations. What's happening? How dare they do these things? Imagine now being forced to flee from Syria or Nigeria or Ukraine as they remove them just systematically from their homes. Exiled, alone, scared, and the hatred increases with every meal they miss and with every indignity they suffer. Of course they're angry. You know, we live more blessed lives than them, sure, but we still have it. It still hits us when that job's given to someone else who definitely deserved it less. When the police ticket you or maybe force you to do something without provocation. Like, how dare you? What is this system when that friend that you knew had your back betrays you? When that pet that you love more than anything is dying? Yeah, pets who become faithful companions and friends. When your daughter makes that terrible decision again? It's one thing after another. Maybe you're angry on behalf of other people. Maybe for the last few years you've been angry on behalf of Peter. Lost his wife, what? How can this be, God? She was wonderful. Maybe you feel some of the same for me. I've gone through the same thing. Or maybe not somebody who walks on a stage. There's probably dozens of you right here, right now, who have lost someone so close, and it's not fair. And I can tell you, I've had those feelings. It's not fair. The person that had more joy than anyone that I knew, the person who served anyone and everyone, the person who wanted to spend full time in an Indian village loving orphans full time, who spent all of her time in Maryland teaching inmates in prison, rescuing people from sex slavery, helping in a thrift store, mentoring teenage girls, sending out encouraging notes, doing her devotions every morning while I checked Facebook. She's making a difference in the world and God takes her. How dare you? It's not right. It's not fair. And people get angry, and of course they do, and they want to strike out because they think somehow that'll make things better. They want someone to blame, and they can't always find someone, so they have to blame God. And I'm way off point, the main point of this psalm, but can I plead with you as a pastor? It's okay. He's big enough. He can handle this, but he's not doing this to you. That's not the God that we serve. He didn't make your husband leave or cause your daughter to make that decision or step on you when you're down. There's a story, Pastor Maurice White, at Lenten service, he was saying goodbye to people as they were leaving, and one of the older ladies stepped down the stairs and she fell on the brick stairs and she hurt her hip something fierce, and she ends up in the hospital, and amazingly, she doesn't ever come out. There was no reason this should have happened, but she died. And so he's there a few days later at the viewing. You know, it's the viewing the night before, the funeral's the next day at the viewing. And he's mulling around and he's talking to people, and people are hurting and people are trying to give advice. And he starts hearing this. God must have had a plan for this. So we need to accept it. It's God's will. We have to live by it. Somehow God has planned this to test your faith. And another one said, there's a silver lining in every cloud. You'll find the reason, God's reason behind this eventually. And Pastor White is just getting more angry the whole time. He's listening to all the things. And he goes home and he rewrites his story. And it starts off with this line: my God does not push old ladies down church steps. Then he proceeded to explain what I'm trying to explain here, that God is the author of life, not death. If you want to be angry at the darkness in the world. Be angry at Satan and his chaotic forces, and perhaps be angry at yourself for allowing some of this darkness to continue. But if you're going to do all that, don't stay there. Don't stay there too long. Look to the cross. Look to the cross. For it's here that all the anger of the world focused its deathly attention. It's here that the King of Peace laid down his life so that you don't need to suffer this damning guilt. Look to the cross, Christian. Look to the cross, whoever you are here. Maybe God has brought you here and we don't know exactly why, what he's doing with you. Look to the cross. Perhaps you're here and you're searching, wondering, who is this God? And oh my goodness, this is in here? I can't. Maybe you felt oppressed and angry and sad. Maybe everything is good. Maybe you're happy. I don't know where you are on this continuum of life. You've probably been in all of the different places from time to time. Wherever you are on this, may I call you all to the same thing. Look to the cross. It's here that we find hope not only for us and for our hearts and our souls, but for the world. When we read this psalm, we don't cry out for vengeance. Justice, yes. But not vengeance. Our heart, our focus, our eyes go to that hill in Jerusalem, a place where the consequences of a sinful world find their victim. A place where the king of the world takes the curse, the imprecation, this curse on himself for us. A place where he cried out. Remember this, what he cried out. Father, forgive them. That's not a curse. That's the exact opposite. It's the cry of a loving king who's ready to throw your sins into the deepest sea. And yeah, you've got plenty of them. And I don't mean ethical things that you didn't do right. I mean, you're choosing not to represent God well in the world and giving the powers of darkness the right, the worship. And he's going to say, I know you do that, and I love you so much, and I'm going to bring you in, and I'm going to show you something new. I'm going to show you a new way to live. Father, forgive them. Jesus said, if it's me or them, it's me for them. It's me for them. There's a song which hopefully maybe Dante will put on first this week, hopefully, this week. It's by Gungor. I just want to read a few things from it. It says this. When the lines are drawn, when you're in or out, when it's us or them, and we shame the doubt, it's all a lie. All we ever really need is love. There's no need to shed more blood. Look upon the cross. Look upon the cross. See the face of Christ. See the mercy in his eyes. Every valley shall be lifted high. Now our enemies are blessed. The heavy laden rest, for his judgment is love. His judgment is love. There's no more guilt. There's no more shame. All our darkest sin, all our deepest pain. Blessed are the poor, all the lonely, broken, lost, and torn. See, a kingdom comes to us. A war that's fought with love. Our only war is love. Prepare the way of the Lord, wielding mercy like a sword. Every mountaintop will be made low. No, he holds the earth like dust, and his judgment comes to us, and his judgment is love. His judgment is love. We will not fight their wars. We will not fall in line, because if it's us or them, it's us for them. It's us for them. We reject the either or. They can't define us anymore, because if it's us or them, it's us for them. It's us for them. Who's your enemy? Who's the one who's hurt you? Who's the one who's brought this pain on you? Give everything for them. That's the call of the cross. Take up my cross and follow me. It's sacrifice. Look to the cross, both for your hope and for your call. Look to the cross. Let me pray for all of us. I know people here, Father, who have gone through really dark times. And I pray that you would show your loving kindness to them right now, your chesed, your covenantal faithfulness. Put your arms around them. I don't know what that'll look like. I don't know if it'll mean someone in this congregation is going to come up and give a hug, or if they're just going to feel something right now from your spirit that is different than everything they've felt before. But I pray that you would speak to them in ways that they would hear and feel. And I pray for those who are just angry. And yeah, Christians get that way, I know. I pray that you would focus their eyes on the cross of Christ. This moment in history, this objective thing that happened, that Jesus gave his life for the world and then rose again and empowers us to do the same. Be with your people. Grab hold of their hearts anew today. Be with those who don't yet know you. Help them to see Christ today. Make us peacemakers, lovers, and we will give you the praise and the glory for all of those successes. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.